This week on the Best of Flashpoints, an update on the critical situation in Honduras, including a report under fire with tear gas from the streets on Friday as President Zelaya re-enters the country. Our special correspondent Dar Jamail talks about his new book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, and why the U.S. military is trying to keep a tight lid on the burgeoning GI resistance movement. And JR and the Block Report discuss new updates in the case of Oscar Grant, murdered by an Oakland BART cop in January. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Dennis Bernstein and JR. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We continue our drumbeat coverage of the volatile situation as the coup government in Honduras attempts to maintain power and the resistance movement grows to bring back President Zelaya. Joining us from somewhere on the ground in Honduras is Cliff Ross. He's a writer and director of Venezuela, a revolution from the inside out. He's a translator, a marvelous poet, and he joins us, as I say, from Honduras. He has spent a lot of time in Central America and knows a great deal about the region. Cliff, it is good to have you with us. Last I heard, you were on your way to the Nicaraguan border. What's going on?
Well, thank you for having me on your show, Dennis. It's a weird thing here. They only tell you what's going on. I mean, and it goes by text messages. You only find out what's going to happen a few minutes before it happens because the government, for example, today we were going to be leaving in the afternoon to go to Nicaragua to meet President Zelaya and accompany him back to Honduras. And the coup government, the golpistas, have decided that now they're going to have a curfew of 6 o'clock along the border. So that prevented anyone from getting there because we couldn't get there by 6 o'clock. And so we would be breaking curfew, and that could be serious. So we're going to be leaving very early tomorrow morning and going to Nicaragua.
And the idea is you have received information that President Zelaya will, in fact, re-enter Honduras through the shared border with Nicaragua.
That's what I understand. Yeah, that's why we're going there. And it's going to be a pretty big caravan. From what I understand, people are going to be converging from all over the country to meet President Zelaya and accompany him back. So we're still hoping that they're going to be able to resolve this peacefully. But it's not looking very good, actually. It's looking pretty sketchy. I guess is the word we'd use.
Let's talk about it. More than sketchy, we could say rather repressive and violent in terms of the coup government. Give us an update in terms of the resistance movement, where what the mood is and what kind of repressive actions you've been able to document.
That hasn't been something that I've noticed too much because I I'll tell you that honestly, I just walked through the Plaza Central, which had a big reggaeton concert going. I was going to meet my friends there, and I thought it was a concert for the caravan. So I had on my hat with Mel Zelaya, Presidente de Todos, Mel Zelaya, the president of all Hondurans, and I was walking through the plaza, through this whole thing, and trying to find my friends, and then my friends arrived, and they said, hey, take off the hat. This is an opposition meeting. And so I was walking through this whole plaza and never had a problem. So, I'm sure my blue eyes help. What's happening outside of Tegucigalpa, no one still knows. I mean, the information is so difficult. I mean, I'm writing a piece which probably will come up at Counterpunch or Dissident Voice tomorrow on the media. The media is just, the piece is called Surreal Honduras, and that's really what it is. It's beyond magical realism. It's a dystopian novel in the sense of the way.
Are you saying there's a blackout of information?
Well, no, I'm saying there is worse than a blackout. I mean, a blackout would just be blank pages, and far more dangerous is when people think they know what's going on. There is disinformation campaign like I've never seen before against Hugo Chavez. And, you know, of course, I made the movie about Venezuela. I've lived there. I know what's going on in Venezuela, and it's not perfect, but there are a lot of good things going on there. And Chavez has a big mouth, yeah, and he blusters a lot, sure. But he also is a remarkable leader. And what's happening here is, I'm just looking at an ad. I was writing about this in my article. There's an ad, the full page ad that came out. And, you know, there isn't a good newspaper here. There's one that comes out, a monthly newspaper that's pretty good. But the daily paper, El Heraldo, is making claims that Chavez is infiltrating with his army and accompanied by a bunch of narcos that he's paid to invade and to bring in to kill Micheletti. That's what was in the newspaper. And of course, according to sources, you know, the usual. And this one, the newspaper, it's a full page ad, and it has up at the top Chavez aiming a gun. And it says, Chavez calls for violence and he wants bloodshed in Honduras. And then a big, big blue banner that says, but Hondurans want peace, unity, democracy, and freedom. And it's a big march underneath of people with their, you know, Honduran flags and dressed in white, you know, who is the people from the national party, the conservative party. So what's going on is basically a way they're portraying Chavez as a devil. They're demonizing him and saying that he wants to invade Honduras and take over the country and, you know, with a bunch of narcos. And so it's just, it's absurd, the kind of propaganda. And unfortunately, it's having a real powerful effect here in Tegucigalpa. But on the other hand, what people who are poor, which represents probably 80%, if we can go by what the poverty rate is in most countries in Central America, that 80%, you know, of course you've got some people who are going, you know, don't really understand what's going on, but I just got out of the cab and the cab driver was just giving me, you know, the rundown on what goes on in this country and that Zelaya really has done things for people. He said he doesn't just talk, he does things. And so they're, you know, but what they're trying to do is they're trying to associate him with Chavez and Chavez as if he were some, you know, horrible, you know, imperialist. And in fact, you know, unfortunately, people seem to be much more inclined toward supporting the United States than they are toward Latin American unity. And it's, you know, at least a lot of in particular sectors. But it's very definitely a class situation, a class conflict. You know, the majority of the poor people have benefited from Zelaya. And I can't, honestly, I can't say, I know all about his policies. I haven't got a lot of background. I'm still trying to educate myself here. But what's really very clear is that Zelaya has done some really good things for people here. He's brought more national police in on the force. They were out on strike today, and I was just up here. The Northern Highway was shut down from 8 to 2. There seems to be some sort of an informal arrangement, informal kind of a agreement between the opposition, the resistance, and the Micheletti forces, that the resistance will take over the highway during the general strike, which is today and tomorrow, from 8 until 2, and then they'll let traffic through. But it was a pretty dramatic closing of the highway. And
what happened today? Did they close down the highways?
Yeah, they did. Oh, it was totally closed down.
Were you there? Tell us about what happened.
Well, I got there late, but it was closed down. There was traffic backed up for probably a couple of kilometers. One thing that just stands out for me was I was just leaving. When I was leaving in the afternoon, just about the time they were getting ready to lift the blockade, the police came. A truck with two policemen came, and they tried to come through. And the resistencia said, "No way you're going to come in here. Sorry." And the truck just stopped there for a minute, and then they just started backing up, and then they just kind of sat there for a long time and called in like, "Hey, sorry, we can't go through." So it was blocked off. They had, you know, people brought in rocks. They covered the highway, the highway with rocks. And the truckers were there with their hammocks strung under the trucks, and they were kind of taking a siesta. And it was some music and a lot of garifunas, and a lot of different, the different cultures of Honduras were represented there. And teachers and nurses were there, and the nurses provided food, and it was a very festive atmosphere. There is a sense of fear, but I don't think that anyone, you know, there hasn't been a lot of overt repression yet. I think that what everybody's afraid of is that Micheletti, you know, we've got a conflict here between principles and power. Micheletti wants power, and Zelaya stands for principles, and that's what people see it. You know, poor people, working people. That's the way working people see it. And you know, if they don't win by principles, then I don't know. Everyone's very worried about a civil war here, and it would be devastating. The army is with Micheletti, but the national police are with the people. But the loyalty is only is not very, very deep. Today they went out on strike because they haven't been paid, the national police. So the national police were there in the a lot of them were there in the blockade, and but the military was there, and I saw the military talking with people. I mean, we're not in the 1980s. It's very definitely a different situation. So far, there has been a lot of restraint, I think. They've been, you know, Honduras is very well known for very specific targeted murders and assassinations of leaders to decapitate movements and keep them from building. I think they kidnapped the mayor of San Pedro Azula. Still, we haven't heard anything here in Tegucigalpa about what's happened to him. We don't know where he is. He's been disappeared for probably over a week now.
This is by the coup government.
Yeah, by the coup government. And so we don't know what's happened to him. And there are, you know, of course, there were a couple of murders here and there. But so far, it seems that the coup government is really is pretty restrained because they've been in discussions, and things are really for them actually quite tenuous. And I think I don't think any of them want to end up facing war crimes charges. Should Zelaya actually manage to get back in the country and be reestablished, and the people are utterly and absolutely determined to bring him back.
All right, Cliff Russ, we're running out of time, so we're going to want to keep in touch with you. We're going to do a special report on tomorrow's edition of Flashpoints here on Pacifica Radio. As you said, you're going to be part of a caravan heading down to Nicaragua, where Honduras shares a border, and
yeah.
You're hearing, I'm not sure how you know Zelaya is going to come in through the Nicaraguan border and not the Guatemalan border, but you're pretty sure of that.
Well, the people here in the resistance are counting on it.
All right.
So I don't know if that's any indication, but it looks like a pretty good bet. I'm ready to go to Nicaragua to find out.
All right. Well, we're going to keep in touch with you. We thank you for the good information and all the reports, and we'll be talking to you soon, Cliff Ross.
Okay. Thank you for having me on your show.
Bye-bye. You are welcome. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And as I said, this show will be back and will be devoted to seeing what happens as the people continue to resist the coup government and fight to get the duly constituted elected president, Zelaya, back into the country. An amazing and a crucial story for democracy and the Bolivarian Revolution in this region. Incredibly important story, almost totally dropped by the mainstream media. I'm Dennis Bernstein.
Perdieron sus colores al saber que... This is Tim Russo from Free Speech Radio News. I'm in Honduras, in El Paraíso, 12 kilometers from the kilometer from the border with Las Manos, the border with Nicaragua. We're actually right now, you can hear tear gas being shot at us. We're running with the crowd as the police are beginning to repress us here, where there's been a very pacifist demonstration all day long of about 5,000 people that are trying to get to the border to greet Manuel Zelaya, who has at this point already crossed the border between Nicaragua and Honduras. He's in Honduras right now, and he's walking towards El Paraíso, where we are, just 12 kilometers from the border. The police, about 10 minutes ago, began shooting tear gas into the crowd that was fairly mellow here, although they were setting fire to tires just in front of the police line. I believe the police got a little upset with that and have since begun to come into the crowd. Again, what we've heard on Radio Global, which is one of the few radios that's transmitting much of the activities that are taking place, not only here, but throughout the country, was that de facto President Micheletti had prepared a letter of resignation that has been approved by the Congress in the event that Zelaya accepts one condition, and that's that Zelaya turn himself in and retire from the presidency as well in order to name a third person, neither of two, as president. This happened just moments ago here. There was a sense of euphoria in the crowd here in front of the police at El Paraíso, which is the last roadblock before reaching the border. But what folks here had understood was that Micheletti had resigned, which is not the case. A letter is signed. It has been approved by the Congress, but there is this one condition, and that condition is that Manuel Zelaya not return as president. Right now, you can hear some screaming of the people. The crowd is coming back towards the police line. The police, what they've done is moved in front of where the tires were set on fire. And sorry that I'm a bit out of breath, but we've been just enveloped by the tear gas here.
All right, let me jump in here for a second, Tim. Let me jump in. This is Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Tim Russo. He is just a few miles from the border where President Zelaya has re-entered Honduras from Nicaragua. Say a little bit more about what you know in terms of him actually stepping into the country, and what is the state in terms of President Zelaya? Is he surrounded?
Yes. What we heard and then what we saw, I happened to be interviewing some women in a small house just after the first repression here, right about the time when Manuel Zelaya crossed over the border. What we saw that was being transmitted live there is that he was surrounded by probably nearly 100 journalists or 75 journalists and about 400 supporters that did manage one way or the other to reach the border. Many people made it to the border by hiking through the mountains from Olancho and Catacamas to the border, avoiding the main roads. Also, many supporters from Nicaragua accompanied him to the border where he crossed over. There's a small chain on the border. There is two lieutenant colonels and a colonel of the 101st Airborne, Honduran Airborne, that are set up a command center on the border. We spoke to these three gentlemen, these three officers yesterday when we came to the border to see what the situation was, crossing eight roadblocks to reach that area. Those three men said that they were waiting for higher up orders, that they were waiting for orders from Tegucigalpa, from their general, sort of washing their hands of anything that could happen to Manuel Zelaya. He has walked across the border about an hour and a half ago, I'd say, and was on his way by foot to walk these 12 kilometers from the border to El Paraíso. What we've heard, and we're trying to confirm, is that there's been a couple calls made from Zelaya, from the border, to Tegucigalpa, the capital, to see if they can arrange some sort of negotiating team that arrives there to see what the conditions are that Micheletti, the de facto government, are trying to impose for the resignation. Here again, where we are, just 12 kilometers from the border, despite this recent repression and tear gas right now, people are regrouping and there's still a sense of euphoria, feeling very much that they've won, that Zelaya is in the country, and now that he's in the country, there's not much that the de facto government can do.
All right. Tim Russo, Free Speech Radio News, we want you to keep in constant contact with us on Flashpoints. We're going to follow this with you through the afternoon, and hopefully we can bring you back at live 5 o'clock California time. Please be careful. Anything dramatic happens, call us right back.
Okay, Dan. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. As President Barack Obama sends more U.S. soldiers to occupy Afghanistan, deepens the permanence of U.S. military bases in U.S.-occupied Iraq, prepares to deploy 1,400 troops to Colombia, and continues torture and interrogation operations in Guantanamo, there are growing numbers of troops from within the Army battalions who, like their predecessors in the Vietnam War, are widening the pockets of resistance to the United States' projects of illegal and immoral military occupations. In his new book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, award-winning independent journalist and Flashpoint special correspondent Dar Jamail dives into the stories of everyday soldiers within the ranks of the U.S. military who are taking a stand in stark dissent of the policies of our government, facing court-martials and jail time. But as Jamail points out, quote, it is even more commendable that they have found within themselves the energy and resolve to deploy the precious assets of sanity and emotional intelligence to accomplish the two-pronged objective of healing themselves and reclaiming the ideals of democracy by making public their resistance. Joining us to talk about his new book and the growing GI resistance movement is our special correspondent, Dar Jamail. Dar is the recipient of the 2008 Martha Gellhorn Award for Journalism, the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism, the Joe Calloway Award for Civic Courage, and the Lannan Foundation Writing Residency Fellowship. He speaks to us from his new home base in Marfa, Texas. Dar, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Great to be with you, Nora.
So let's jump right into the news and your brand new book, The Will to Resist. I think the publication is actually very perfectly timed because it looks like the GI resistance movement is rapidly expanding. Recently on truthout.org, you broke a story about U.S. Army Specialist Victor Agosto, who publicly refused to deploy within his unit to Afghanistan and was about to receive, quote, the harshest court-martial possible for his decision, one that would land him in jail for up to 1 year, followed by a dishonorable discharge. But within hours of the piece's release, Agosto was told by the military that his court-martial had been reduced. Dar, what does this say about the atmosphere within the military court system as more and more soldiers show up at the doors, adamant about refusing to continue these unjust and illegal occupations?
The military is scared. They are in a situation now where literally just over the last 72 hours, we've seen Secretary of Defense Gates announce that he's going to increase the number of troops in the Army by at least 22,000 up to 30,000. We're looking at even more soldiers on deck now getting ready to be deployed to Afghanistan. By the end of the year, there's going to be 68,000 American soldiers in Afghanistan, and I think we should expect that number to increase. We are already looking at a military that's stretched thin. We still have over 130,000 troops in Iraq. Troops are not being withdrawn from Iraq. They're being relocated to different bases, some of the bases still within cities, but they are not being withdrawn thus far. So we're left with a situation where the military is still scraping and clawing and trying to get as many boots on the ground in both occupations as possible, and they're desperate. So when you have a guy like Victor Agosto, a specialist in the Army, out here at Fort Hood in Killeen, Texas. He's already served 13 months in Iraq. Very articulate, very charismatic, has a very deep political understanding, as well as a very deep fundamental understanding of the U.S. Constitution and international law. And he takes a stand and says, you know what, I'm not going to deploy to Afghanistan. I think it's unjust. I think it's immoral, and it does not make our country any safer. And then he basically pulls the sheet away from the facade, showing that despite being the just war that everyone just assumes that Afghanistan is, even so many people on the left, he actually points out, no, actually, it's not a just war. And his lawyer, James Branham, goes on to say, look, this occupation of Afghanistan is in direct violation of the U.S. Constitution because of the Supremacy Clause. And the Supremacy Clause says that there are only a U.S. obligation to adhere to international law, and that surpasses all U.S. state and federal law. So when the U.S. signed on to the UN conventions, which of course it did, it means that we have to adhere to the fact that there are only two reasons to justify this country to go to war. One, in self-defense. Two, if it's a war that's been ratified by the UN Security Council. Neither one of those applies to the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan. It was not the country or the people of Afghanistan that attacked the United States. Therefore, the U.S. has no right to be in there in the first place. It's in direct violation of international law. So Victor Augusto was basically going to be put on trial for a court-martial that would land him in jail for up to a year and give him a dishonorable discharge. We ran this story. His lawyer threatened to basically put the war on trial, which is exactly what Aaron Watada did back in 2006, and all hell broke loose. And the military did not want to repeat that. They didn't want to risk having other journalists show up and start covering the story. Excuse me. And they certainly didn't want to risk other soldiers hearing about this. This is a very volatile spark on a very, very dry prairie of military dissent, where most of the guys I spoke with when I interviewed them for this book, I found the most common theme was, look, I'm speaking up about this, and there are 10 other people for every one of us that's speaking up about it that very much oppose what's going on, but most people are too afraid to speak up about it. And the thing that Victor Augusto did is he took a bold stand, and he's not afraid. And we're starting to see that more and more. More and more soldiers are stepping up, and they're not afraid either.
That's the voice of Dar Jamail. And Dar, in your book, The Will to Resist, you introduce the readers to an array of soldiers who have dissented. And as you say, you thread it all together to illustrate this common anger at the establishment who have made possible these illegal and unjust occupations in Afghanistan and Iraq. And after many years of reporting on the effects that these wars have had on the Iraqi and Afghan people, you turned your attention to the effects that are had on U.S. soldiers who are deployed to wage these wars of occupation. Tell us about what you found in common with the soldiers and what surprised you the most.
Well, I have a common bond with so many of these people in that all of us who've spent time either in Iraq or Afghanistan, whether it be as a soldier or as a journalist, nobody gets out unscathed. All of us came back home with post-traumatic stress disorder. All of us had the nightmares. All of us had the recurring thoughts and the memories of watching the hell that and being amidst the hell that war really, really is. And you know, when I spend time with these people, we relate. We understood the fact that we came back to the United States and we were both in a position of actually, you know, it felt like coming into the Matrix or something where we're amidst all these sleepwalking people that aren't aware of the fact that there's a massive war going on. There's people being eviscerated by bombs on a daily basis. And people here, their main concern seemed to be like what kind of latte to get at Starbucks. And how do you struggle with that? How do you reconcile those feelings and the emotions elicited by that experience? And I started talking with these guys and realizing that for them, as I had my own process to go through with PTSD, for them, it was very, very cathartic and healing to talk about what happened to them in Iraq, what they saw, what they did. And then even more so, I think really a key point in the process for them really reclaiming their humanity was, what am I going to do about it now? What am I going to do? Am I going to resist, or am I going to continue to be part of this war machine? And basically what these guys had in common is, especially the folks that I interviewed in the book, is they stood up and they basically wiped the muck of the U.S. military off of them and then said, I'm going to fight this, and I'm going to join in with other people who are going to fight this. And so the book is basically a collection of really amazing stories of people with very high morals and integrity, as you said during the lead, a very clear emotional intelligence about what they're doing, and they're resisting, and they're learning about international law and the U.S. Constitution and what their rights are in the military, that they do have rights, and that there are resources and organizations available to back them if they do want to take a stand. And more people are doing this. I mean, we can look at the figures coming out, even from the Pentagon, and we're looking at For example, there's been huge numbers of suicides. I mean, this is just a kind of an indication of how quickly the U.S. military is falling apart, where back in 2007, we had 115 suicides. In 2008, we had 133. And already for this year, we're well over 80 confirmed cases. We're well on on track for another tragic record. In addition to that, the Pentagon also has revealed back in late 2007 that there was an 80% increase in overall desertion rates in the Army, and Army AWOL rates from 2003 to 2006 were the highest they'd been since 1980. And also, between 2000 and 2006, over 40,000 troops from all branches of the military had deserted. In fact, even in just talking about the Army specifically, from 2006 to 2007, we saw a 42% increase in the number of desertions. And this is actually backed up also by more recent information by the group Courage to Resist right there in Oakland, who has tracked how many people are calling them, and they're looking at, I spoke with one of their office managers while working on an article recently, and he said they've actually in recent months had a 200% increase in the number of people contacting them to get support because they're going to resist orders to deploy.
200% increase. That's the voice of Dar Jamail. And Dar, you have an entire chapter dedicated to the investigation of the culture of self-censorship within the military. What are the risks that are associated with speaking out? You know, even though there's a 200% increase in the rate of desertion, there still is a lot of factors associated with dissenting. Talk about that.
Well, it's very, you know, the military makes it known that for anyone who's going to disobey orders, and certainly for anyone who's going to go public about it, like Aaron Watata, like Victor Augusto, like others, that they're going to threaten them. They are going to threaten them with the most severe court-martial possible, up to a year in prison, like what happened to Camilo Mejia, who spent 9 months in prison for being very articulate and public about his defiance to redeploy to Iraq. The military basically is going to, these people know the military is going to throw the book at them. And so the military does things like issue kind of these broad edicts that, you know, you're not to talk to the press. And I saw this firsthand working in Iraq, that, you know, most of the soldiers I would run into were scared to talk to the press. And it was difficult to find folks who would be very candid and forthright with me on the ground. Literally, I would go up to people and start talking with them, and their commander standing behind them would say, you're not going to talk to that guy. And that's basically how it's carried out. There is broad censorship on up to the point where actually, you know, the most recent example we have is this soldier over in Afghanistan who's been captured by the Taliban, and everyone has probably seen these photos or a clip of the video of him. And actually, there was a spokesperson for the U.S. military being interviewed on Fox News just the other day about this. And this person basically, and I'm going to just definitely paraphrase here, but this person basically said, first of all, we don't know what's happened. We have to wait until all the facts are in, but then completely contradicted himself and went on to say, look, this guy is collaborating with the Taliban, and basically, if he dies, he dies. I mean, that's basically the gist of what he said. I mean, it sends a very, very clear message that if you, even if you're captured, because this guy's on camera saying things like, the Americans need to pressure their government to bring us all back from Afghanistan. And absolutely, it's propaganda, but clearly this person is under duress. And the point is that the military, if you're not in lockstep with their message 100% of the time, they just assume you're throwaway to them. You're trash. You're detritus. You're useless. And that is kind of the motivation behind, you have to stay on message. You have to keep your mouth shut. You're going to just follow orders. You're not going to question anything. And certainly if you're going to dissent, and certainly if you're going to speak up and refuse to deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan, we're going to make your life hell. But again, the reality is they rely on this myth that they can do whatever they want with you as a soldier. And it is just that. It's a myth. There's nothing to back it up. As a soldier, you have rights. There's a lot of resources available. There's the GI Rights Hotline. You can get lawyers. You can get media backing. You can get people to help support you if you're going to resist. You have a lot of options. There's a lot of things you can do as a soldier. But unfortunately, like censorship in the corporate media, most people aren't aware of this. Most people are in fear. They feel like they need the job. They can't afford to risk losing it and losing pay. They're afraid of what the military is threatening to do. When in reality, the brunt of this, if you stand up, as Victor Augusto's lawyer said, if you stand up and you're bold and you're public and you're very clear about what you're doing and very smart about how you do it, there is no reason for you not to be able to resist and take a stand and not have to really actually suffer much consequences at all, and then be a fine example for other people to follow. And again, that's starting to happen more and more.
And there is support out there. Dar, what's been the significance of what you call organized resistance with movements such as Courage to Resist or Iraq Veterans Against the War and the Winter Soldier testimonials that are still happening across the country?
Well, it's still, we're in a situation, and this is where I want to be really clear, that there is not an organized GI resistance movement. There's nothing that we can compare today to that which we had during Vietnam, which essentially brought an end to the war. I mean, most people don't know, but by the end of Vietnam, just about half the troops on the ground literally would not follow orders. Fraggings of their commanding officers were happening every other day. People were completely addicted to opium and all kinds of other drugs. I mean, the U.S. Army was basically shot. I mean, it was useless. And thanks in large part to an organized GI resistance movement of hundreds of GI coffee houses, over 100 underground newspapers. I mean, it was a politically smart, well-organized, powerful GI resistance movement that basically forced the government into a position where it said, look, we can't wage war because we don't have an army that actually will function. And so we don't have anything near that. We don't have very broad organizing at all, unfortunately. However, what we do have are plenty of seeds, plenty of examples, and the book really just touches on, I would guess, maybe 3-4 dozen of them. But the book, these are people that are really, they're taking these stands. They're very smart about how they're doing it. It's in different areas, whether it be, you know, publicly refusing orders, knowing you're going to get court-martialed, and being willing to risk a year in jail like Victor Augusto and Aaron Matata have done, or whether it's using art as resistance or other methods, and organized resistance, as you said, where groups like Iraq Veterans Against the War have had organized these winter soldier events where soldiers are coming back from both occupations and sharing their stories and talking to the media that will listen anyway, about what they did, what they saw, showing pictures, showing videos, trying to educate people, tell them the truth about what's happening. So this is happening, albeit in quite a fragmented way, but this is very, very important. It is continuing, and the fact that it's not getting more media attention than it is does not mean that it's not happening and does not mean that it won't continue.
And this takes us into other subjects you unravel for us in your book, in which speaking out and organizing against unjust practices of the military on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan also parlay into standing up against unjust practices from within the military as well. As you know, as people begin their dissent against the wars, they also stand up against homophobia, racism, and sexism within the military itself. Dar, tell us about the rampant cultures of discrimination and how they factor into the GI resistance movements.
Yes, very important points. I think overall the book's very positive. It's uplifting. It's hopeful. But I think one chapter that's was very brutal to work on and is very brutal to read is the one on sexism and resisting sexism in the military. And it's because and this applies both women and men, but of course, that the U.S. military being one of the most misogynistic cultures on the planet, women are going to be paying a far, far higher price in that culture. And basically what I found is that if you're a woman and you're thinking about joining the U.S. military, you need to consider the fact that even according to Pentagon statistics, you basically have 100% chance that you will be raped or sexually assaulted. So you need to keep that in mind if you're a woman and you're going to be joining the military. And I cite two statistics from that, both from the Pentagon. One is that 80% of all sexual assaults in the military go unreported. And then another one, actually, that comes from the VA, I'm sorry, not from the Pentagon, But according to the VA, 20% of all females in the military are either raped or sexually assaulted. So if 20% admit to it and then 80% go unreported, you can do the math. And that's where I come with 100% chance of being raped or sexually assaulted. And that's what I found when I interviewed a good number of women, both veterans and active duty, veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, but also veterans from a long time ago, from the 80s and some even as far back as during Vietnam. And it didn't matter what I was talking about, the story was always the same. Commanders abusing their privilege, abusing their rank, to basically threaten women and force them into having sex with them, as was the case with Suzanne Swift more recently. But this has been happening for ages. In fact, this has been happening as far back as the Revolutionary War, back in the late 1700s, where women have joined a very misogynistic culture, and they're forced in, they're put in a position where they're basically, the odds are completely against them. And then when they try to seek justice for it, less than 10%, of all these military sexual traumas, the MSTs that are and the rapes that are reported by women in the military, less than 10% of the perpetrators are ever brought to justice. There likely is not going to be a court martial. And then of court martials that happen, basically it's slap on the wrist kind of stuff, like, oh, don't do that again, now go back to your job. So, we haven't seen any corrections being made in that regard whatsoever, despite the fact that even in the last 9 months, we've had several hearings on the Hill, putting the military on the hot seat. What are you doing to correct this problem? And the military continues to say, yes, we're instituting these programs, we're going to make things better, but nothing's changing. And I literally called the Pentagon about this while I was working on a story ways back, and the spokesperson at the Pentagon told me, one of the things the military was doing to rectify the problem was asking people to watch each other's backs. So guess how well that's going to work.
That's the voice of Dar Jamail. He's talking about his new book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Dar, you mentioned the role of art in how soldiers are dealing with PTSD, loneliness, trauma, social exile, rape, sexual assault, and guilt after the roles that they may have played in Iraq and Afghanistan. Tell us more about that. What kinds of creative resistance are happening within the ranks of the dissenting military?
I ran into a soldier named Drew Cameron. He served in Iraq. He's from Vermont. And he, along with some help of another friend of his, had basically set up a program where they ended up calling it the Combat Paper Project. And he came back from Iraq with all of the post-traumatic stress disorder and all of the conflicting feelings that we were talking about earlier. And he realized, look, I need to do something. I need, I have these uniforms. I need to do something cathartic to heal from this. And he literally went through a process where he stood there and had a friend take pictures of him when he did it. And he was wearing his uniform, and he slowly cut his uniform off of him, and then shredded it, cut it into tiny little bits, and then his friend, who had a paper mill in Burlington, basically said, let's make paper out of your uniform. And so he literally took his uniform, created a pulp out of it, made paper on it, and then started using the paper to journal about what happened in Iraq, to write poetry about his experiences in Iraq, to paint on it. And then this started turning into more and more veterans coming up and joining him in pulping their uniforms and making paper out of it and creating art on it. And then this turned into one book, and then it turned into two books, and then it turned into an exhibition that's been traveled around the country. And I think I could be wrong, but I think it might actually be traveling around the country right now, having openings, bringing more people in, inviting more veterans to do the same thing. And now there's talk of them trying to get it over to Europe to tour it around there as well. So that's one example, on top of the fact that there's now been a large number of soldiers who've written books about their time in Iraq. I mentioned Camilo Mejia earlier, and he wrote a stunning book, The Road from Aramadi, about his experiences in Iraq and then his experiences as a war resister and conscientious objector. And we can talk about a number of books like that. In addition to others, I found who take art into the streets, doing things like going out into the street with chalk and drawing giant doves and stopping up traffic and using their body to literally stop traffic and make people stop and pause in their busy days and look at his message, an Iraq vet talking about peace, writing about how awful the occupation is, these types of things. There's also been plays. There was a U.S. Marine named Jeff Key, who's in the book, who came back and basically made a really stunning one-man play called The Eyes of Babylon that has he's run that for several months in a couple of different locations, and was actually went to the Democratic convention in Denver and then stayed on there for another month and did his play there, bringing more awareness to people about what's happening in Iraq, what the U.S. military is doing there, and the cost that's having on both the soldiers serving and of course, the people of Iraq. So it was actually a really fun chapter to write, because there's been all kinds of amazing, creative, beautiful acts of resistance that have taken the form of art.
And finally, Dar Jamil, as President Obama prepares to send another surge into Afghanistan while retaining tens of thousands of troops on the ground in Iraq, how do you see GI resistance and popular civilian resistance against war and occupation merging? And what are the next steps that both people on the street and people in the military need to take right now?
Well, the seeds of resistance are there. And I think that really, and I basically end the book with some of the words of Aaron Watada, the highest ranking person in the military to refuse a combat deployment to Iraq at the time. This was back in 2006. And he basically talked about the fact that he laid out a blueprint for a GI resistance movement in this country. And I think really, once again, just like everything else, Nora, the onus is on our shoulders, that it is up to the average person in this country, to the civilians in this country, to really organize a potent anti-war movement, start having strikes, start doing direct action, start being engaged in civil disobedience, not carrying out business as usual and going through your day as if nothing is happening. And one of the ways that people can support GI resistors and really start to help form a modern, powerful, organized GI resistance movement is to find soldiers in their community. And this is what Aaron Matata suggested. Find soldiers in their community who are going to resist, and then come up to them as a community and say, look, we know that you want to resist. We know that the reasons you struggle to do it is because of economics, and you're worried about your family and other people that are reliant upon your paycheck. And so we've got your back. We'll make sure that your family is taken care of. We'll make sure that their medical is taken care of. And this demands real sacrifice. But if people are really serious about being anti-war and anti-occupation and changing the policies of this country, it's not going to happen without a GI resistance movement. And that means people are going to have to make real personal sacrifices to step up and offer your resources, to share your resources with these people, and let them know that you have their backs and you're going to do whatever you can to support them. And that's what has to happen. And that's very tangible things that people can do, especially in the Bay Area. I mean, Courage to Resist is always looking for people to help. That's a great organization that can help get lawyers behind GI resistors, to help get them media attention, to sometimes, you know, to help them in other ways as well. So people need to basically decide, how serious am I about being against the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan? And if I'm really serious, then what am I willing to sacrifice to help some of these soldiers who are going to refuse? Because if you do work that helps one person refuse to deploy to either of these occupations, you're saving that person's life, and you have no idea how many lives of Iraqis and Afghani people you'll be saving.
We're going to leave it right there. That's the voice of our special correspondent, award-winning independent journalist Dar Jamil. His new book is called The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, with a foreword by Chris Hedges. And people can go to your website at dar.org, that's spelled dahr.org, for more of your reports. Dar, congratulations on your excellent and meticulously researched book. We're, again, thoroughly impressed with your work, as we have been over the last 6 years. Thank you so much for being with us again on Flashpoints.
Well, thank you very much, Nora.
We go to the Block Report for an update on the Oscar Grant murder case.
You're listening to another edition of POCC Block Report Radio with the Minister of Information, JR. Today, we're going to be talking to Rakia Mohammed Jibrin. She's an educator as well as an activist who's been very involved in the Oscar Grant case, or I should say the Justice for Oscar Grant case. And she's been also involved in one of the founders of Cop Watch Oakland. Rakia, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you, JR. How are you?
I'm good. Well, to kick it off, let's just get right to business. I know that you were a constant spectator in the courtroom in dealing with Messerly, who was eventually indicted for the murder of Oscar Grant a few weeks ago. And I understand that he's had a number of hearings since. Can you speak on what's been going on in court in dealing with the case of Oscar Grant, particularly with Johannes Messerly?
Yeah, so definitely. So two things have been going on. I think that the defense, which is Messerly's defense lawyer, Michael Raines, has been attempting to prove that Messerly, Johannes Messerly, was mistaking his taser for his gun. The other thing was that he was attempting to prove that the act was not intentional, the act of murdering Oscar Grant III. And so what has been going on in court is that Michael Raines has been calling a lot of BART police officers to the stand, specifically Anthony Peroni, who was one of the first BART police officers to get on the platform that night, as well as Marisol Dominici, another BART police officer. And Michael Raines has been asking a lot of questions, or he did during the preliminary hearing, to establish that Johannes Messerly had made a mistake. What we know from the outcome of the preliminary hearing is that it was not a mistake. He definitely intended to take out his gun. And what also came up during the preliminary hearing was that both Marisol Dominici in particular and Anthony Peroni, as it seems, definitely had something to do with that murder. And I think it's really important that we pay attention to those two in particular, and we pay attention to their testimony, because it seems like there was a lot of, there was definitely a lot of contradictions in their testimony all, while on the stand. And I don't think Johannes Messerly is the only one who should be set to try.
Contradictions like what?
So specifically, there were contradictions even starting from when Marisol Dominici and Anthony Peroni had gotten word from dispatch that they were needed on the scene at the Fruitvale BART station. They, on dispatch, they had gotten word that there was a call for a 242, which is a battery call, but no one had actually said anything about a gun being on the train or that there was a gun involved. And I think most of their testimony was based on the fact that there was a threat on the train, that there was a gun on the train, and most of their testimony and most of their excessive force was justified. They justified it specifically saying that they were looking for a gun, right? And we know that in Johannes Messerly's, you know, in defense of Johannes Messerly, so many people were saying, well, he thought that Oscar was going for a gun. And Anthony Peroni had definitely stated that Johannes Messerly had told him on the platform, I thought he was going for a gun. And I think we need to pay attention to those minor details that are said on the stand. Oh, well, you know, Marisol Dominici had stated that originally dispatch had told her there was a gun involved. And when the prosecuting attorney, Stein, questioned her further, it came out in her testimony that actually dispatch had never said there was a gun on the train. The other thing is that the perception of threat was just exaggerated to the point of straight perjury, meaning that they lied, you know, on the stand. And I think we need to pay attention to that. What was the threat exactly? Much of the testimony of Anthony Peroni and Marisol Dominici was that there were crowds of people coming off the train. Crowds of people. I think Anthony Peroni had said that it was almost like the noise of a football field. That was inaccurate. And much of the video that was shown in court, very crisp, very clear, demonstrated otherwise and contradicted what they had actually said on the stand while they were on the stand.
So now, where is the case at? I understand he was indicted after that series of hearings, and you said now it's going to preliminary in October, am I right?
So the preliminary hearing established that Johannes Messerly would stand for trial for murder. So the murder's trial starts October 13th. I think it's going to be very important that people show up, people show solidarity, that people show support for the Oscar Grant family, but specifically that people come out and speak out against police brutality in Oakland, which is just so prevalent all throughout Oakland.
So can you speak to these next hearings that are coming up in a few weeks?
Yeah. So I think what the defense attorney Raines is trying to do is he's trying to, one, to some extent, ask for the charges to be dropped, which I don't think they will be. But I think his intention at the arraignment on June 18th, Johannes Messerly was arraigned in front of a different judge, Judge Jacobson. basically Reins wants to push for a motion to change the venue of the hearing, of the trial. So they're trying to move it out of Oakland. And I think that's the priority for the defense right now. The defense, they're actually, Reins is carrying out a survey. So he has an expert, apparently, who will be surveying potential jurors. And what that expert might do is testify within the month of July. So July 24th, I think people need to be present. And mid-September, it might be September 18th, but we have to get clarification on that date. That the testimony from the expert will determine whether they have found that they can carry out this case in Oakland. And my guess is they're going to say that they cannot. And so we really need to stand up and sort of speak out against that. I think we need to say something to the district attorney about keeping the case in Oakland. I think it's important that this case stays in Oakland and not be moved away.
Why would the defense want the case to be moved out of Oakland?
Well, I think it comes down to what sort of jury they're looking for, right? They want a jury that is going to, in some ways, not understand the plight of black people. You know, I think that's what it comes down to.
Right.
And I think we've seen this with many other cases in the past, and we've seen cops get off, right? And I think that it's important that people understand what black people go through. I think that's a reality in our country. I don't think it's a biased reality. I think it's just a plain reality. And moving it out of Oakland to a less diverse, less attuned community that has not been following the case, that doesn't know the excessive stress that is on people of color by police in a police state is detrimental to this case, but also detrimental for police activity in the future throughout this country.
Well, I know that as a result of the murder of Oscar Grant, you and a few of your comrades have created the Oakland chapter of Cop Watch. Can you speak a little bit about how it was founded and what is the purpose as well as the activities of Oakland's Cop Watch?
Absolutely. Oakland Cop Watch started out right after Oscar Grant was murdered by Johannes Meserle. And I think pretty much it was just Oakland residents who were frustrated, really disturbed by police brutality and excessive force, police racism, state racism in Oakland, who have neighbors and family members who themselves have been affected by the stress and the racism of police and of the justice system. And so we have come together in hopes of acting as both observers and advocates, acting as community members to watch the police. I think police need to be watched, and it's unfortunate, but I think that's just the reality. Again, we have to look at what is the reality. Why are police using tasers excessively? Why are they using their guns excessively? What follow-up is there? And I think just from the Civilian Review Board hearings that have been happening in Oakland, we see that even the Civilian Review Boards have not been able to fully investigate. They haven't been given the time. The Internal Affairs Department of the Oakland Police Department has not adequately followed through on investigation processes and given the Civilian Review Board enough time to carry out their own investigations. And I think that we have to actually get out on the street. So aside from the bureaucratic processes of investigations or people filing complaints, so much of the time police are not even disciplined. And so much of the time the Oakland Police Department says that they are following department policy when we see shootings happening, when we see excessive taser use happening. And there are many things that are never filed, right? So we need to be out on the streets watching cops. We need to create a culture of watching, of accountability, of stopping police terror in our communities.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.